Welcome to the Florida Roundup statewide edition today. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. I'm in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Good to be with you, Tom. Well, a state judge in Tallahassee this week ruled that Florida's 24-hour waiting period for abortions is unconstitutional. Now, a Gainesville clinic had challenged the law last year, and the Florida Supreme Court put a temporary stop to that waiting period while the legal challenge was being considered. This ruling from Judge Terry Lewis makes the halt permanent.
Melissa, this law was passed back in 2015. It was signed by Governor Rick Scott. It required women to have at least two medical appointments, one to seek the abortion, the other to have the procedure done. This 24-hour waiting period was required to give the patient time to be fully informed about the procedure. Exceptions could be made, though, for medical emergencies and in cases of rape or domestic violence. Now, Florida's defense of the law was led by Attorney General Payam Bondi. The defense argued the importance of protecting unborn children rather than lessening obstacles for women seeking an abortion. But the judge in the case here, Melissa, ruled the state simply has no compelling interest for making women wait.
That's right. And so we begin the Florida Roundup this hour by asking you, what do you think of the judge's ruling on abortion in Florida ending that 24-hour waiting period? It was never really widely enforced anyway. It was always being challenged in court. But let us know what you think about this. Give us a call here on the Roundup from anywhere in the state. The number to join the show, 305-995-1800. And here with their thoughts on this ruling, we welcome Carolina Bellotta with the legal news service Law 360. Also with us, Rachel Iacovone. She's a reporter with WGCU in Fort Myers. Carolina, let's begin with you. Let's go back to 2015. Why lawmakers passed this bill to begin with was the idea to give women more time to decide whether they really wanted to go through with the abortion?
Hi. Yeah, it was sponsored by Representative Jennifer Sullivan, and she, I think, if I remember correctly, that the reason she gave was that she had seen women pressured by spouses, boyfriends, or other family members, and she focused her advocacy of this on making sure women were fully informed and were not pressured into making a decision that was irreversible.
Right. And so, Rachel, let's talk about in the two and a half years or so that this law was officially in effect, was it even really ever put to use? It had been halted temporarily, challenged in court. What was the real impact of it in the state before the judge's ruling just now? Okay, I don't think
law for the state.
Rachel, give us that one more time. We had a little audio connectivity problem there. We're still having a little bit of technical difficulties, Melissa. We'll get those sorted out with Rachel. Carolina, in the meantime, what was the practice of this law in the 2.5 years it was on the books?
It actually has... It was only ever enforced for about 2 months, I believe, after the first DCA opinion that in February 26, 2016, that reversed the temporary injunction. And then the Florida Supreme Court reversed that decision in April 22nd. So I don't think it had much of an effect because it really wasn't enforced for very long.
Yeah, for much of its life, Melissa, it was in court as opposed
That's
to
right.
In the medical clinics.
So, Rachel Iacovone, was there any indication that the number of abortion procedures went down during the time frame that this 24-hour waiting period was on the books?
Well, there is no real reliable information right now on it because there is no required studying of these centers and there is no regulation. So the bills now would codify into law that there would be constant supervision of these centers in the state.
And so as the Florida legislature meets, just as the judge's ruling is coming down, Carolina, they're already introducing new measures to limit abortion in the state. There's a measure that's being put forth by a couple of Treasure Coast lawmakers that would ban a common procedure during the second trimester of an abortion. It's called a D&E. It's typically done when the patient's life is in danger, but the bill refers to this process as a dismemberment abortion. What about that measure that's up in Tallahassee right now?
I think it would be, the thing with these abortion laws is that, as we see with the 24-hour waiting period law, they have to pass strict scrutiny, which is the strictest, most difficult, process of legal review that the courts undertake. And so the government really has to show a lot of evidence and that they are being, that there's a very compelling government state interest in order to encroach on a woman's constitutional right. So these laws like these would probably have a difficult time in the courts.
This compelling interest threshold was among the points that this Judge Lewis in Leon County in Tallahassee pointed to in putting the permanent injunction in place, stopping this 24-hour waiting period from being enforced in the state. Is that the guidance, essentially, though, to the legislature, that should they be passing any additional abortion measure, that's going to be the legal threshold that it's going to come up against, ultimately, in a challenge?
Essentially, yes. And I think this isn't really something that's new. I don't think that Judge Lewis is suddenly enforcing strict or applying strict scrutiny to it's not a new thing to apply strict scrutiny to this to abortion laws. So yes, that's essentially the case.
If you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup. The number to join the show, 305-995-1800. What are your thoughts about this ruling ending the 24-hour waiting period on abortions in the state of Florida? Lisa is in Naples. Lisa, you're on the Florida Roundup. Good afternoon. What do you think?
Yeah,
Lisa, you're on the radio.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the unfairness of this law and to say that I've been working on it, doing some lobbying, and I've been doing research on it through various organizations, one of them being the Floridians for Reproductive Freedom. And the problem with this law, the biggest problem with this law, was that it unfairly targeted the least powerful, the most vulnerable women in our state. To give you an example, so let's say a woman has two other children. She might be in an abusive relationship. She becomes pregnant. There's no way to afford the third child. She needs to, first of all, make an appointment to a clinic that could be 200 or 300 miles away. Mm-hmm. Then she has to find childcare. Then she gets there, and instead of having the procedure, she's told, I'm sorry, but we need you to wait 24 hours until you finally make up your mind. It unfairly targeted these women, and it also sent a message to women that they have arrived at the doctor's office having not thought this through, that they have not spent time with their faith leader, their families, and made this decision, and as if they're having that extra 24 hours was going to make a difference because this is an impulsive decision. So for all those reasons, I, for one, am very happy to hear that the law has been permanently blocked.
Lisa, thanks for your thoughts on that. Now, meanwhile, lawmakers have also introduced a new bill that mandates pro-life information be provided through crisis pregnancy centers in the state. That bill is ready for a vote by the full House. Now, the state already funds a network of crisis pregnancy centers. Under this new measure, the Department of Health would be able to contract only with providers that exclusively promote and support childbirth. Pro-choice activist Chriselle Bailey says these clinics don't educate women on all of their options.
We oppose any legislation that forces Florida taxpayers to fund fake clinics that operate with virtually no oversight and judge, shame, and intentionally try to trick women out of getting the care that they are seeking.
Under the bill, public funds would not go to clinics that provide abortion services. Now, 19-year-old University of South Florida student Annie Filkowski testified in front of a Senate panel in November about her experience at one of these centers in Fort Myers when she was 16.
When we walked in, I assumed the women at the front desk were friendly. They were nurses. They were wearing scrubs. They asked why I was there, and I responded in a sympathetic manner. The room they took me into looked nothing like a doctor's office I have ever been in before. It looked more like a therapist's office. There was one big couch, a love seat, a tissue box, and a Bible.
All right, Rachel, let's talk about this new bill that's moving through the House, likely to pass, and what would its fate be in the Senate? Your thoughts.
So according to all of the experts I've talked to, specifically ones from the National Organization for Women who have been following this bill since it was in session last year and failed, they're saying that since it's passed in Senate, it's going to pass in the House as well.
And so it would go to the governor's signature. And this basically is saying that state health agencies like the Department of Health could only work with centers that are pro-life. That's not all the legislation says, but that's part of it, correct?
Yes, and that's the part that people are taking the most issue with. But another line in the bill says, and I quote, requiring services to be provided in a non-coercive manner and forbidding inclusion of religious content. Now, you heard in that clip from Annie Filkowski, when I spoke to her, a big issue she had was all of the religious content that she was given there. And now, if this passes, religious content would not be allowed any further.
She talked about the folks there at the clinic having a Bible with her in that piece of sound there. It is the Florida Roundup statewide. 305-995-1800 is the telephone number. In Plantation in South Florida, Fernando is on line 5. Fernando, your thoughts.
Good afternoon. I'm not too familiar with the law, but I had a first-hand experience. I did put a lot of pressure on a pregnancy of my wife when we were having our fifth kid. And we were having financial difficulties, and I did. First of all, she was not a pro-choice believer, and I am, and I was definitely not wanting to have that kid. But thanks to the advice of her OB-GYN, we took time to think about it and seek counseling, and we ended up having our baby, and it's been a blessing, and I think that, you know. The good thing on having that time is that not only she had internal peace, but I was able to convince her on the benefits of being pro-choice, and instead of forcing it into her, now she believes it's an option, and we still had our baby, and I think it would have had devastating effects on her if we would have rushed the decision and probably our marriage.
Fernando, we appreciate you sharing your story with us. Do you feel that that waiting period ought to be required, as was the effort of this law that was overturned and called unconstitutional this week?
In general, I do agree. I think that I have four daughters, and I would like them to have a choice to think about it. I still think that the exceptions that were provided were sufficient, or maybe more exceptions could be included, but I do feel that it should be necessary.
Thanks for that call, Fernando. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. And it's the Florida Roundup. What do you think of the decision ending the 24-hour waiting period on abortions in the state of Florida? 305-995-1800 to join us anywhere around the Sunshine State. Rosa is in Fort Lauderdale. Rosa, good afternoon.
Yes. Hi, good afternoon. I am really glad that this was made permanent. I believe that the 24-hour waiting period is just one more way that Tallahassee lawmakers are attacking women's choice and women's right to self-determination. And I also wanted to bring up that the court cited the privacy clause in Florida's Constitution. Florida is just, I believe, one of five states with a clause in our Constitution that guarantees our right of privacy even beyond the U.S. Constitution. And there is a proposal, Proposal 22, which is being sponsored by an anti-choice commissioner of the Constitution Revision Commission to basically get rid of the privacy clause or shrink the privacy clause. And it's really an underhanded attack on choice, because even though this commissioner, John Stenberger, is purporting that this is, to guarantee privacy of information, what it really would do is restrict our privacy clause and get rid of so many privacy protections, including health care, abortion care, end of life, same-sex adoption. So I just want to urge everyone to please be on the lookout for this proposal.
Yeah, thanks for that, Rosa.
Thanks for that. Carolina, did this privacy issue come up in the judge's ruling?
Not that I remember. It wasn't a big thing. I mean, I think that the gist of it was basically the decision was basically the government did not provide enough evidence showing why there was a compelling government state interest to enact this.
And Carolina, what about the Constitution Review Commission and just further efforts to change the definition, the legal definition of privacy in this state? Of course, Roe versus Wade, you know, the 45th anniversary of that decision is coming up later this month. The whole ruling around that decision was about a woman's right to privacy.
I honestly am not up to date on what CRC's privacy. There are so many proposed amendments, so I really can't comment
yeah,
on that.
There are quite a few. Yeah,
yes.
Dozens of them. Yeah,
we've had trouble keeping up with them, but I haven't seen that one. But I'm definitely going to look it up.
Let's squeeze in one more phone call here, Isabel. You've been waiting on the line patiently. Let me push up line two. There you go, Isabel. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. I am an RN. I've been an RN for about 20 years, and I work in women's health presently. I work at a clinic site that does offer abortion services. And so I want to just tell you that I, of course, am in tremendous support of the removal of the 24-hour waiting period or the permanent injunction. I do agree that it is a matter of a compelling interest. I feel for the gentleman who spoke about his wife's decision and his. But as Lisa said, the women that come in are frequently those who are the most disadvantaged. They only have one day to do it, and it's a tremendous burden for them to have to come back. But additionally, nurses are the most trusted profession in the United States 16 years in a row. Personally, I have counseled young women to make sure, as all our physicians do, that best choice is right for them. And frankly, I have had at least one young woman, after speaking with her, who said, you know, I don't think I want to have this done today. And I have absolutely taken them out of the, clinical area and said, that is wonderful. That is your choice. I celebrate that and I support you. So it is a matter of communication that is going on between a woman, her family, and her own self. Sometimes, however, you'd be surprised, a communication between a woman and her physician or her nurse can just make that crystal clear. And it's not all about making women have abortions. It's all about allowing them to make an informed and educated choice.
Well, thanks for that perspective from a nurse calling the show. Thanks to all of our callers on this issue. As the 24-hour waiting period on abortions is overturned by a judge, great to have both Carolina Bellotto of Law 360 and Rachel Iacovone with WGCU in Fort Myers. In a moment, the debut of Red State, Blue State, a new segment on the show. You won't want to miss this. You're listening to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And in Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. Melissa, this was the week. This was the week for the 2018 legislative session to begin,
yes.
And the gavel fell, beginning lawmakers back to work in Tallahassee. A 60-day legislative session is now underway, but boy, oh boy, oh boy, the ceremonial events marking the start of the annual session really were overshadowed by the latest sex scandal in Tallahassee. You know, while leaders gave speeches about tax cuts and zero tolerance for sexual harassment in the Capitol, just hours earlier, two senators, one Republican, one Democrat, issued a joint statement admitting to an extramarital affair.
Yeah, talk about reaching across the aisle, Tom. Senate Minority Leader Oscar Brainin, a Miami Gardens Democrat. I couldn't resist. The Democrat, Oscar Brainin, and the Republican, Senate President Pro Tempore Anitira Flores, Both admitted to the affair. They said their longtime friendship had become something more, and they asked for forgiveness. Now, the statement was released from the pair after a website went up showing hidden camera video from the condo building where both lawmakers live when they're in Tallahassee. Neither of them has resigned over this scandal, but this now makes four state senators who have been involved in sex scandals recently. Democrat Jeff Clemons quit after admitting to having an affair with a female lobbyist, extramarital affair. And Republican Jack Latvala resigned under pressure while under investigation for sexual harassment and misconduct. These are charges, of course, he continues to deny, Tom.
Yeah, he does. And of course, all of this is just in the atmosphere. It's in the air hanging around as lawmakers begin the work on really a long list of what are contentious issues, taxes, education spending, abortion, as we talked about in the last segment, even immigration, a federal issue, is still playing out at the state capitol. Here's Governor Rick Scott in his last State of the State address this week.
We have a finite amount of time left in these positions. Let's all fight together and to our last minute in office to secure Florida's future for each and every family.
To fight together is what the governor said. Well, Melissa, he has not been a publicly collaborative governor with Republicans, his own party in the legislature, in past sessions. Last year, for instance, there had to be a special session because the governor and his fellow Republicans just disagreed over education spending.
Yeah.
Now, former Congresswoman Gwen Graham, you spoke with her this week. She's running for Florida governor as a Democrat.
When you're in office, you're serving the people who give you the honor of being there. And we need to get back to an ability to talk with one another and work through the important issues facing Florida.
So taxes, education, spending, immigration, on all of the big issues, Tom. Florida is, of course, both a red state and a blue state, split right down the middle, the very swingiest of the swing states. With that in mind, we're kicking off a brand new segment on the show, Red State, Blue State, as we welcome perspectives from both sides of the spectrum and from different parts of the state. Republican strategist Rick Wilson up in Tallahassee and down in South Florida. Democratic strategist Fernand Amandi joining us via Skype. Gentlemen, good to have you both. You know, they always say in Florida you have to go north to get to the south. So we're going to start up at the top of the state with you, Rick Wilson, our Republican here in Red State, Blue State. Let's begin as we talk about this legislative session with the state budget, the governor proposing all these increases in environmental and education spending, just as he prepares for a U.S. Senate run. Interesting to you?
Well, of course. I mean, we're in a situation right now where Rick Scott is probably the most equipped candidate to run against Bill Nelson in my political career, where Bill Nelson has always had the luck of pulling the worst possible candidates against him in the past, who either weren't prepared to run a race against him or financially able to. And Rick Scott's on the one hand, on paper, in a very good position on that. But on the other hand, it is a very purple state. It's a very swingy state. It's a state that has broken fairly hard in terms of the overall opinion in the state against the president, who is an ally of the governor. And so, he's got a lot of challenges to try to patch and paper between now and when the election really heats up. And so he's going to try to shape a legislative set of outcomes that make him look a little more Floridian and a little less MAGA.
Yeah.
I'll say that Senator Nelson probably wants to run against President Trump, not against Governor Scott.
Absolutely. To Rick's point, he's on the money that Bill Nelson has lived a charmed political life in terms of drawing opponents. And I think if it were any other set of circumstances, any other year, it would be a very difficult one, because we've seen Rick Scott, with all of his deficiencies, he's not the perfect candidate. He is a always well-funded candidate. He is disciplined to the point of distraction in terms of staying on message. So from a campaign consultant's perspective, he's a dream candidate. However, as you point out, Tom, this is not going to be an election that has anything to do with anything except Donald Trump. And it's going to be a referendum on Trump. And there's a very smart strategist I know that has suggested that everything Trump touches dies, and that applies to his relationship with Rick Scott. The fact that Rick Scott has been cozy with Donald Trump has been coveting his entrance into the race, could very well be the MAGA touch of death if indeed Scott gets in. And I think the fact that he hasn't gotten in at this point is the best evidence of how much he is reconsidering that this might not be the time to run. And I've even heard that he may very well be seeing what happens if Donald Trump decides not to run for re-election, and he may mount a candidacy on the Republican side in 2020.
Well, maybe President Trump is the 161st member of the Florida delegation in Tallahassee at this point, the shadow member here. Red state, blue state, Republican strategist, Democratic strategist here on the Florida Roundup. Let's hear from red state, blue state, purple state, no party affiliation, what have you. You can join the conversation on the telephone, 305-995-1800, how politics are playing out in Tallahassee, and of course with the state budget and with all these issues, Melissa, we've talked about education, taxes, health care, environmental spending. 305-995-1800 is the phone number.
That's right. And Fernand mentioned Rick Wilson's famous or infamous catchphrase, I guess, depending on where you sit politically, everything Trump touches dies. You're even making a documentary film, I think, titled that, Rick.
We are.
Okay.
Yes, we are.
And we can talk about that in a minute. But first, do you agree with your Democratic counterpart down there in the southern tip of the state that Donald Trump is going to cast a pall, I guess it's one way to put it, over this state legislative session? And as they try to figure out the budget, by the way, the influx of refugees from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, there has to be accommodations made for that voting group as well. That could affect the budget. Do you agree with Fernand, or do you take a different point of view? How do you see this session playing out in the governor's final stewardship over the budget here in Florida?
Well, I think there's a complex sort of multivariate problem to look at with the legislative session. You have Rick Scott, as we mentioned earlier, who looks to achieve a set of outcomes. And look, those outcomes aren't entirely political and about the election, but they have an overhang on that. They have an overlay of that. And you have Speaker Corcoran, who obviously would like to run for governor and is in that particular fight, who would also like to have a set of outcomes in this election to, you know, work on establishing himself as the guy with the sort of right Republican and conservative bona fides for this race. And so, you know, there will be a lot of questions from folks inside the process and outside the process as to whether or not this election is driving the agenda in the legislative session. That's inevitable. It's happened in the past. It'll happen in the future. It's not about this particular set of men who are, you know, running or considering running in 2018. But it is definitely a factor you will see in terms of how people read the outcomes and the agendas in the session.
And, you know, there are so many issues that you see typically in these sessions, Fernand. Everything, as Tom said, from putting together the budget, which, of course, is their only mandate. They have to do that. Education spending, a number of other matters are catching people's eyes as well. For example, there may be a restoration of civil rights for felons. Children's health care funding. These are highly partisan issues. And as we talk about this red state, blue state, of course, Florida is split right down the middle in terms of its voter base, but not in Tallahassee, where Republicans have long had control. So what's catching your eye as a Democrat, as, you know, some bills are already coming up for a vote, and some of them, as we've been discussing this hour, are going to be quite contentious?
Agreed. You know, the main thing I look at is this legislative session has to be looked at with an asterisk, as it is happening against the backdrop of an electoral year. So as Rick talked about earlier, I mean, you look at a lot of the moves that Richard Corcoran is pushing forward, whether it's the sanctuary cities bill, the hardline immigration bills, bills that really don't have any realistic chance of passing, I don't think, out of this legislature. Those are nothing more than political maneuverings on his part to, I guess, appease the base of voters that he would be looking for should he declare a candidacy for Florida governor. But again, I think we are in such a unique backdrop where the national political environment plays such a heavy role in what's taking place in Florida. You can look at these individual bills, you can look at individual legislation that is being proposed and say, well, it may be a factor in what happens in statewide contests. But given the dynamics that we're seeing this year, I see so many other factors being the impulse besides what type of events we may see in November, something that very few people are really starting to pay attention to, but I think is a huge factor. I think Rick would agree with me on this. You've had an influx of a quarter of a million Puerto Rican voters mm-hmm. that have now yeah. called the state of Florida home
yeah.
That mm-hmm. weren't there as recently as 6 months ago. And in a purple state, maybe, you know, 10,000 new voters could make a difference. You're talking about 250,000 pissed off Puerto Ricans that want a revenge vote. And they're literally calling it that. Hashtag revenge vote against any Republican, because remember, everything that Trump touches dies. So his stewardship of Puerto Rico, it doesn't matter what the Republican senators or the Republican candidates for governor talk about, they're going to have to pay an accounting for that national consideration.
You're from two different parties, but you're in agreement on that catchphrase, at least.
Sure,
it seems like, Rick.
And I will say this also, and Fernanda's exactly right. You've got a quarter of a million new Puerto Ricans in the state. And behaviorally, the ones that were already here had broken toward the Democratic Party pretty significantly, even before the disaster of this last year. You've got now about 300,000 Haitians in the state, of whom about, Daniel Smith says, are about 160,000 of them are registered voters. Mm-hmm. You've got a rising number of voters from the Dominican Republic. You've got a rising number of folks, again, from Haiti. And you've got a situation where at the top of the presidential ticket, or at the top of the political, you know, pyramid, you know, you've got a president saying these are the shithole people. And I mean, call me crazy, and I've only been doing this for about 30 years now, but I the last time I checked, and I'd have to focus group this, but calling people folks from shithole countries doesn't really work politically. It's a quite open question. Generally, no.
And how many times have you said that word today on different media outlets? Just curious.
And by the way, we don't need to say it anymore.
Yeah.
I think everybody understands that the word exists and that the president uttered it.
In the last 24 hours, something like 472 times.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, you know, all of this is happening and has, frankly, taken the oxygen of politics in Florida. Certainly the S-hole comment on Thursday in the Oval Office in reference to Haiti and Haitians has taken all the air out, which had been kind of polluted, the atmosphere polluted, with the sex scandal in Tallahassee. Let's not forget, it was only Tuesday of this week where two sitting senators, veteran senators, leading senators of their parties in Tallahassee, just hours before the gavel fell in the opening session for the legislative session, acknowledged to having an extramarital affair with one another and said that they were not going to resign. This, Fernand, already in the atmosphere with two senators previously resigning, one from each party, an investigation into former Senator Jack Latvella continuing, referred for criminal investigation here, and the Senate really on its heels in terms of an institution as it looks at its agenda driven by Republicans.
No doubt. And, you know, and as strange as the politics has been in now infamously weird Florida, what we've seen is that the Me Too movement, Florida has not been resistant to its borders in terms of seeing that here. And I think some of that is in play. But let's look at truly what this question of this affair is. It's certainly salacious. It's certainly a political intriguing issue. I, for one, don't see it having any impact whatsoever in terms of the Senate itself, in terms of what legislation will be impacted by this revelation, none whatsoever. However, I think there are two major aftershocks about this that are going to have some consequences, one minor and I think one major. Let's start with the minor one first. Already in political circles in South Florida, Tom, where you're based, and I'm sure you're already hearing it, there is talk that Oscar Brainard, who was the Senate Democratic leader, had pulled some punches in terms of running Democratic candidates against Annie Terra Flores the last time she was up for election. So I think you'll see some internal pushback and you know, what is the consequences of that for the Democratic Party, especially across the state and South Florida, where Oscar Brainard is based.
Okay, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. I know you want to get that second point in, Fernand, but first let's go quickly to Karen in Wilton Manors. Hi, Karen.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Hi there. I was calling to talk about two things. First of all, even though I'm here in Broward County, I'm paying attention to the Margaret Good campaign. She's running for State House out of Sarasota. And the reason I'm paying attention to it is I wrote postcards on her behalf I'm a volunteer with postcardstovoters.org. And as I said, even though I'm here in Florida, I've been writing postcards for statewide special and election candidates throughout the country. We wrote for Annette Tadeo here in Florida as well. So that's one thing I wanted to talk about. And then the other thing is, you know, no matter how well people perceive Rick Scott did during this hurricanes, he is a climate change denier, and he scared people to the point where they were stuck in 8 to 12 hours of traffic. And if he would acknowledge climate change, we could actually make improvements so people don't have
okay,
to leave.
Sure.
But then we could also do local shelters.
Thank you, Karen. Okay.
And I'll take my comments off.
That's here. A great segue into our red state, blue state divide here in this state. On the one hand, you have people living along the coasts worried about sea level rise. On the other, you have a governor who really hasn't acknowledged the threat posed by rising oceans. Fernan, what about her points? And then I know you wanted to make your other point as well.
Well, I mean, look, Florida, without a question of a doubt, is the most vulnerable state to climate change, I think, in the United States, and certainly southern Florida, where all of the scientists, it's no longer a question of debate. The question is not so much if, it's a question of when. So I think there's a tremendous sense of concern about that. And yes, unfortunately, many members of the Republican Party in Florida just are either unwilling or unable to acknowledge the threat that it represents. But I think even when it comes to buttering bread, you saw this week, President Trump initially called for a lifting of drilling off Florida's coasts. And sure enough, Rick Scott, governor of Florida, worked out a deal with the president and Rick Zinke so that that wouldn't happen. And certainly there's a recognition and acknowledgement of certainly the environmental impact of such a deal. So even though they may not be leading with the rhetoric, I think even the most ardent deniers like Rick Scott are aware that there's a political consequence of this, that they just let it go unfettered.
Maybe offshore, but there's been continued efforts to drill for oil and fossil fuels in the interior of Florida, in the Everglades, and that has been a state issue that generally has been supported by Rick Scott's administration and agencies. Red state, blue state here, statewide on the Florida Roundup. You can join our conversation. How are you seeing politics and the political issues that are under the rotunda in Tallahassee? And for that matter, we'll be at the ballot box in the months ahead here in 2018. 305-995-1800. Republican strategist Rick Wilson in Tallahassee will continue with us, and via Skype, Democratic strategist Fernand Amandi. Stick with us. 305-995-1800. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. Thanks for listening today. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, as we've been discussing a little bit this hour, the political world is on fire today, and there's consternation in capitals around the world as well, after multiple media outlets reported that President Trump used an expletive during a White House meeting with congressional leaders. He was describing his thoughts about immigration from some African countries. Now, Trump was unhappy about a bipartisan plan that would bring more immigrants from Haiti and some places in Africa instead of other countries like Norway.
Yeah, also countries in Central America included in the president's comments yesterday from the Oval Office. He denies that he used that language. The remark, though, drew swift condemnation around the world, also here in Florida, especially here in South Florida with a large Haitian population. Lawmakers, meantime, in Tallahassee are considering a bill that would ban so-called sanctuary cities here in the Sunshine State and require state and local agencies Melissa, to cooperate with federal immigration officers.
That's right. We continue our red state, blue state discussion now with a closer look at HB 9 and the issue of sanctuary cities, as Democratic strategist Fernand Amandi and Republican strategist Rick Wilson continue with the show. It's 305-995-1800. Give us a call on the Florida Roundup. What do you think of the proposed ban on so-called sanctuary cities in Florida? Rick Wilson, I believe either you or Fernan mentioned a moment ago that House Speaker Richard Corcoran is supporting this as part of his bid to run for governor. Sanctuary cities in Florida, is there an actual sanctuary city in Florida realistically now? And would a ban change the situation on the ground? Rick?
Well, look, this particular legislative initiative, and Richard's a friend, and I like him, but this is obviously playing to the Fox News crowd right now, who believe that there are 500 million Mexicans who are also Sharia law Muslims lurking under every rock in any city that isn't assertively rounding them up and throwing them out. So, you know, I get why it's a political play. I understand it, but it's also not particularly the jurisdiction of the state in this particular case. Federal immigration law is a federal matter as a general rule. So, you know, I get the symbolic nature of it, and I understand the popularity of it. I suspect that it won't survive, you know, a visit across the Capitol to the Senate, and I definitely suspect the governor won't sign such a thing.
But we've seen, Fernand, local jurisdictions, Miami-Dade County, with a majority foreign-born population, its county commission rescind its own sanctuary city policy. The mayor of Miami-Dade County come out and essentially tell the corrections, the jailers in Miami-Dade County, to follow detention requests from ICE agents, immigration agents, for fear of losing federal funding, federal matching dollars, federal grants in law enforcement.
Indeed, and I think in the case that you're talking about with County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, this was early in the first weeks of the halcyon days, if there will ever be any, of the Trump administration. One of the first acts that Carlos Jimenez did, in fact, the first jurisdiction in the country, a lot of people actually thought it was pre-orchestrated. It happened so pat. But Carlos Jimenez did receive a lot of lumps for that. And you're seeing already many folks saying, while he won't be on the ballot again, the issue hasn't really gotten much traction in terms of detentions besides the little ones we've seen here and there. But I think as far as an issue it goes, it's definitely an unpopular one in South Florida. And again, it just goes into this meta narrative that I think is going to be much more so the overarching theme of the elections, which is what is the Republican Party doing in Florida, alienating all of its ascendant voters, whether they be in Southern Florida, Central Florida, or in other parts of the state. And I think this, as Rick correctly calls it, political posturing around sanctuary cities and the immigration issue can only hurt them in the future.
Now, Rick, this all started a couple of years ago after this incident that happened in California that has been discussed a lot around the country, the fatal shooting of a woman in San Francisco. It was allegedly by an undocumented immigrant who had previously been deported, and a jury found him not guilty in the murder of Kate Steinle. And so for conservative Republican voters, primary voters, this is a go-to-the-wall, no pun intended,
well,
issue.
Finally, this hour,
that, you know, this is something that they expect their leadership to stand firm on. And so as you, a Republican strategist who's so opposed to this current Republican president, how do you see this issue realistically playing out in Florida, which particularly, as Fernand said, in South Florida, there are so many immigrants coming in who are going to be regarding a measure like this with hostility?
Well, look, I'm old enough to have been in this business back when California passed Proposition 187. And Republicans and the governor, Pete Wilson at the time, no relation, they were beating their chests and saying, this is awesome. It's going to turn up our base. It's going to ensure that we're going to you know, keep our Republicans fired up because they hate the problems caused by illegal immigration and da-da-da-da-da, even though we know it's a federal issue. And Proposition 187, by anyone who studied California politics, destroyed the Republican Party in that state.
And do you think that will happen in this state?
I think we could definitely end up in a situation where we permanently alienate a meaningful fraction and the fastest growing fraction of Florida's voters if we don't get smart on this. Look, no one is arguing for allowing people who commit felonies and commit serious crimes to wander free in the streets. No one. That's a fallacy, but the idea that we're going to go out and you know, round up the dreamers and round up people who are here illegally in the millions and millions is also a fantasy, and frankly, I think that has a lot of divisive political impact down the line, especially because, you know, and I'm sorry, maybe it doesn't look this way in Pensacola or in Palatka, but Florida is a pretty diverse state, And Florida is a very closely politically divided state. And Republicans, we've done a lot of hard work for a long time and run really good campaigns. But the Democrats, you know, we're handing them constituencies that are going to be very, very difficult to get back. And it's going to be very, very difficult to convince them that we're not treating them with a racially inflected or ethnically inflected animus.
Well, and it's a growing state population-wise, which means even as that red state, blue state continues to turn purple, Rick and Fernand and Melissa, its leverage, certainly on the electoral side of things, continues to grow as those electoral votes look to grow, perhaps in the next presidential election cycle. Let me tell you, folks, that you are listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
Fernand, with just a couple of minutes left, you get the last word, just luck of the draw. You said you do not see this measure passing in Florida. Do you agree with Rick's assessment that these are the types of measures that could weaken Republican power in this state or not?
Not only do I agree, and not only can it weaken Republican power, it can kill Republican careers. I'm also old enough to remember Mike Haridopoulos was the Senate president in the year 2011, and his number one goal, trying to build a statewide base to run for statewide office, I think it was Senate at the time, he was the guy that was supposed to bring the Arizona-style 1040 law to Florida. That blew up in his face. He completely missed the cards. And that's the danger that Corcoran runs, because the dangerous game is in playing to his base, or as Rick calls it, the Fox News crowd, promising to deliver something that he probably knows is not done. There could be a blowback even internally, which might upend it. So it's a very tricky game, not only electorally, but within the base politics of the Republican Party, too.
Well, Rick Wilson, isn't Speaker Corcoran certainly out on a limb in regards to this sanctuary city ban effort if he is to run for governor? Amongst his other fellow Republican contenders who are not in the state house but also want to be there come 2019?
Oh, well, I suspect Ron DeSantis would be much further to the right than even Richard would be because he has got a specific constituency that he's trying to develop, very much the Trump Bannon model. I think we come down again to, you know, if you're running for a statewide office in Florida right now, are you talking about things that are relevant to every Floridian? Are you talking about things that are going to move numbers outside of your base? I get it. Win the primary. I get it. And, you know, and obviously it's important to win the primary. But are you buying yourself a dead-end street? Are you running into a box canyon on issues like this that allow the Democrats, who frankly, let's be perfectly honest, in this state are pretty terrible at statewide politics.
Well, it shows with the membership in Tallahassee. We got to give it there. It shows at the ballot box. Fernand Amandi trying to get a word in edgewise via Skype. He's our Democratic strategist. Rick Wilson, Republican strategist with us from Tallahassee. Thanks.
Well, finally this hour, Tom, the annual trek to Tallahassee is on, as we've been talking about. Lawmakers, lobbyists, and anyone doing business with the state has to go to the Capitol. But the path to the panhandle can be long. It's 2.5 hours to get there from Jacksonville, 5.5 from Fort Myers, 7 hours by car from Miami. It's no fun.
You've got it. And that's all just with no traffic at all, Melissa, right? So enter in a Delray Beach lawmaker who thinks that Florida's capital should move. Republican Bill Hager is the latest to propose this idea, Melissa. He says it's just too expensive for constituents to travel to Tallahassee. Now, there's a lot of history here. Tally's been the state capital since 1824. That's even before Florida was a state. It was just a territory back then. The 19th century thinking was that Tallahassee was the compromise. It was halfway between what were then Florida's two main cities, St. Augustine and Pensacola.
Yeah, made sense at the time.
Sure.
Now Hager is saying, let's put it in central Florida, make it more centrally located. Hey, you could, you know, get your legislative work done and get in the family vacation to Disney all at the same time.
Which one is the greater show on earth, right?
Exactly right. How about that? That's our show for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami with Gina Jordan and Kevin Merchart, our producers.
Jason Sapka is our technical director with engineering help from WLRN's program director, Peter Maritz. Our theme music is by Miami musician Aaron Libos.
I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening. Have a great and safe weekend.